I've got somewhat of a voice back this morning. I'm going to try not to strain it. So if I'm not speaking loud enough or you can't hear me, give me a signal and I'll move the microphone a little bit closer up. I may just have to hold it in front of my mouth for all I know. Who knows? But this is a test of my voice during class this morning. And if I pass, you may get to hear more of me today. But if not, Ron is going to be speaking this morning and I believe Arthur this evening. If it doesn't hold up, I'm glad to have some good backups here in case I'm not able to do what I'm here to do. We got to page 7 in the workbook, and I don't have any more again, so I guess somebody's coming in here and eating these things when we're not looking. Because I've made 70 workbooks in here, so I'm not sure where all they went. But if you have one at home that you're not using, come bring it so we can give out to somebody else. It's okay if anybody's using them, but let's do use them. Page 7 in the workbook, looking at the prophecies about Christ as the King. If he is to fulfill those prophecies, then he has to have every part of what being a king means. And the verses we looked at on page 6, points 1, 2, 3, and 4, they're under the authority of the King. I think it should be obvious to any honest reader looking at these texts that Jesus had those qualities of the King, fulfilling the prophecies that he came to fulfill. But not everybody accepted him, obviously. The last question we looked at, number 1 on page 6 at the bottom, saw that you basically break it down into two groups, those who accepted and rejected it. It almost broke down the lines of the common people versus the religious leaders. Now, obviously, there are some in both camps that didn't accept or reject. But generally speaking, I think that's a pretty good description of who either accepted or rejected him. Now, looking at question number 2, in what ways did these groups, those who accepted or those who rejected, show their submission or rejection of Jesus as King? And give me some passages to defend your answer. Matthew 15? Okay. Okay. Any others? Elvis?
Yeah, Matthew 20, verse 30.
Okay. Go ahead and read that.
It says here that, behold, two blind men sitting by the road, and when they heard Jesus was passing by, they cried out, have mercy on us, O Lord, Son of David. The multitude warned them they should be quiet, but they cried out all the more, saying, have mercy on us, O Lord, Son of David.
And what is that Son of David?
That's the King,
right? Yeah. David being the King, they knew the prophecy about the King that was to come would be, as was said, that he would, to David, that he would set a descendant of his on the throne to reign forever. They knew that that was the Messiah. And so for them to use that title, the Son of David, they were implying that very fact. They believed that. Okay? Okay. Yeah, Matthew 7, 28 and 29, the people were astonished at his teaching because he taught as one having authority, not as the scribes. They recognized that there was something different about him. In chapter 13, and I kind of had to just put the whole chapter here because Jesus is speaking to a multitude of people. And the fact that you see here in verses 1 and 2, he comes out to the house, sat by the sea, and great multitudes were gathered together to him, so he got in a boat and sat, and the whole multitude stood on the shore. What it tells me is there's a lot of people following him. And looking at the crowd makeup, as you look at all the Gospels, you see that it was pretty much the common people that were doing this. Not going to be a lot of people following someone if they have no interest in him, right? You know, today in our modern social media, Twitter, what is the measure of success on Twitter? How many followers do you have, right? And that supposedly, and I don't know that I necessarily agree with that, doesn't necessarily mean they agree with everything you say, but at least you know that somebody's interested in you and what you're saying or what you're doing. And when you look at what Jesus was doing here, he had a lot of followers. They wanted to hear what he had to say. They wanted to see what he could do. Miracles. They knew that he performed miracles. John 6, we find that people came to him because they heard about the miracles. So they were very interested in Jesus. Chapter 14, verses 34 and 36, through 36. After they'd crossed over, they came to the land of Gennesaret, and when the men of the place recognized him, they sent out into all the surrounding region, brought to him all who were sick, and begged him that they might only touch the hem of his garment. As many as touched were made perfectly well. So here they see Jesus, they know who he is, and so they send out into the entire region there, and anybody who was sick was brought to Jesus. Now, chapter 15, 29 through 31, again, great multitudes, verse 30, come to him, bringing all the sick, the lame, blind, mute. Great multitudes should point toward a great interest in Jesus. And if it was only for the healing, it's still showing an interest in him. They want to see what he can do. And I'm sure like any point in history, there are going to be some who are genuinely interested in what Jesus had to say, but then there's going to be some that are just there for the miracles, then they're going to go home and forget him. Okay. Food. Right.
And, you know, and you think about it, that was a time when people were poor. We don't know what poor is
right.
much in our country. And they were truly hungry.
Right.
But Jesus wanted them to seek him because of the message and who he was.
Yeah, different kind of bread. Right.
Yeah.
Yes. Sure. Yeah, the fact that they are coming from a distance after they find out where he's at, or they're willing to follow him wherever he goes, tells us that they are at least acknowledging that he has that power.
And they still will sit there and listen to what he says.
Right. Bill? Richard. I don't know where Bill came from.
You get over to Matthew 23.
Matthew 23. Okay.
And why they should be listening to him rather than the physicians.
And in that chapter, Matthew 23, I think he gets down to about 28, verse 28, where he really exposes them that they were hypocrites. Mm-hmm. And says it all the way through them. Woe to you scribes, hypocrites. 8 times. Now, here's one of those passages that when we get back to Matthew and we start getting into this a little bit more, we get to chapter 23, there's something said 8 times in one chapter. You can guarantee you that that's the point he's trying to get across. These people are hypocrites. And, of course, they're not going to accept him because they were putting on their religiosity, I guess we could call it, as a mere show. They didn't really care what God said. And as you said earlier, they were following traditions more than God's word.
It's not really what they were looking for.
Right. They were looking for that Davidic kingdom, or Solomon kingdom, where Israel was glorious once again and they were under nobody's rule. But he wasn't that one. And that's part of the reason they rejected him.
Some of them were so excited about having done what they already did. They were just like, "Oh, yeah, we were so excited." Don't tell anybody, but they would run right out.
Right. Sure. Let me throw one more positive side, and then we'll get to the negative side of it. In chapter 21, verses 8 and 9, the entry of Jesus into Jerusalem for the last time. To me, that's pretty much the most obvious and I guess obvious is the best word for it, a display of their acceptance of who Jesus was. They are laying down their clothes before him as he comes in riding on the donkey, putting down the palm leaves, branches. And then they cry out, "Hosanna to the Son of David." Again, there's that term, Son of David. They recognize him as the Messiah and thus the King. And they're, you know, they may not be rich, but they're giving a king's entrance into Jerusalem as best as they can. And one of the points we may miss in this is not understanding their situation at the time. Most people had maybe one or two changes of clothing, period. You know, we've got walk-in closets full of clothes. They had maybe one or two. For them to lay down any garment on the ground for a donkey to come riding over was a very honorable gesture. They were showing Jesus that he was worthy of sacrifice. They were willing to do this. So that scene, as he comes into Jerusalem for the last time, the common people, at least, were accepting him, acknowledging him as the king. Problem is, how much later were they turning around and saying, "Crucify him"? Yeah, just not too long down the road here, probably the same people, because they were stirred up by the religious leaders. So let's get to them, the rejection there. In that same chapter, in verse 23, they challenge him and his authority. By what authority are you doing these things? And they weren't asking because they cared. Now, they had the right to, as the religious leaders, they had the right to ask that question. But they weren't really interested in the answer, were they? Because when Jesus turned it around back to them, you know, the baptism of John was of heaven or men, they refused to answer because they would incriminate themselves or put themselves in a bad light before the people, because they knew the people accepted John and Jesus. So they weren't going to. They were very political. Do the politically correct answer, right, Derek?
Yeah, the same thing happens just before chapter 23, when obviously Jesus comes down very far on the Pharisees. But in chapter 22, at the end, there's the question about Jesus asked the Pharisees the question, "What do you think about the Christ, whose son is he?" And they say, "Son of David." And I would think, given the importance that these people put on lineage, mm-hmm. they probably knew who Jesus' lineage was through. I can't say that for certain, but I think that's a reasonable guess.
I would have thought, I agree, I would have thought that they would probably be checking him out to see where he came from.
Mm-hmm. And so he says, he goes with the conversation about that, how does David in the Spirit call him Lord, and later on we see that they, by their silence, acknowledge Christ and what he's saying here, but they refuse to acknowledge it publicly.
Right.
Again, showing their unbelief in their own body.
Yeah, they would have to, with the knowledge of scriptures they had, couldn't deny what that meant. Mm-hmm. They knew the passage very well, and for him to ask that question, well, who is he speaking of, and how could he call him Lord if he was his descendant? They had to know what that meant, and probably like every other time when they knew what he was saying and refused to say anything, they pretty much exposed themselves as the hypocrites that they were. They really weren't interested. And again, I think John 11 that we read last week, 47 through 53, after the raising of Lazarus from the dead, they didn't get together and say, "Hey, look at this great power. This man must be from God." No, they were saying, "Hey, what are we going to do? If we leave him alone, the people are going to follow him, and we're going to lose our position." And from that day forward, they plotted how to kill him. That was their answer. Right. Right. And so their interest really wasn't in truth. It wasn't ever really about what does God want us to do. They put on a big show about it, and they followed their traditions, which to the people, they made them believe that made them acceptable to God, but Jesus corrected that too. Derek?
And I would say too that would seem an odd thing that they would know that a miracle had occurred and rejected, but it's really not odd because we see it today where men tear those people down because it's not convenient for us, or it's not according to what our own preconceptions are of the truth. So that's not new.
No.
The miracle may have been different, yep. But as far as opposing truth, even in the face of knowing that it's correct, that's not new.
And today, I know when I was younger and less mature, I would look at passages like we have in the New Testament, the Gospels especially. You've got people that walked with Jesus, saw the miracles, heard his teaching, and you think, how could they not believe? Think they walked with him. They saw him. They heard his own words, and yet they still rejected him. Saw the miracles. Because you hear people today say, well, show me a miracle and I believe. No, you wouldn't. Because they didn't back then either. It's an attitude. It's like you said, it's not a new attitude. When today, I mean, stand up in a public arena today, a very wide public arena like the internet or TV, and make a statement and say that homosexuality is not normal. See how far you get. It's not natural. Just say it's not natural. And say, you know it's not natural because they can't reproduce. I mean, that's what we're intended to do. And listen to the outcry. See how quickly you get shouted down and beat down and quieted, silenced. But that's the way it's always been. And again, with Jesus, he came and told the truth. Who's not going to like the truth? Somebody who believes in a lie. Yeah.
You think when Jesus knew their mind and he told them what they were thinking, that they would go, thank you for, you know, revealing the motives of my heart. But today with the gospel, it has the power to reveal the intent of our heart. And that's when people can either reject it or accept it. And that's the message. They hated him all the more for knowing that.
Yeah, I don't know how much of you heard, there was a dean at a Wesleyan university this past week that basically told the students there to grow up. I think his famous statement was, this isn't a daycare, this is a university. Because one student came up to a speaker who had been invited in, and the subject was love, and particularly love your neighbor. And after this lesson on loving your neighbor, the student came up to him and said, He should have toned that down because he felt bad after the lesson because he insinuated that maybe he wasn't loving as he should. And this dean of the university said, that's what you should have felt if you were. But today we want to be comfortable, right? And if somebody comes along and says something that makes us uncomfortable, we don't like that, and we want to shout them down and silence them. Well, it's not any different than what Jesus faced in the first century. He wasn't the Christ they wanted him to be. The religious leaders wanted the Christ to be somebody that was their best buddy, that would grab them up and take them with him as he ruled and threw out those Romans. They wanted to be a part of that. Well, he wasn't doing that. And for him to come in and condemn them, that just kind of sealed his fate because they didn't want to hear the truth. They wanted to be comfortable. They wanted to be in positions of power. Richard? Yeah, and that was right before he ascended. So even they didn't really understand it completely. So that tells me that was a pretty common belief at that time, that they were expecting the Christ to restore the kingdom of Jerusalem or Israel. Further examples that we have of their rejection, we back up just a little bit in chapter 21, verses 12 through 16. After Jesus cleansed the temple there, as he goes into the temple, he was healing some people in verse 14, but the chief priests and scribes saw the wonderful things that he did. You know, I like the way Matthew writes that. Saw the wonderful things that he did, and what did they do? They complained because they called out, Hosanna, son of David, and they were indignant. What's indignant? I was highly offended that somebody would say it. Why would they be highly offended? Because they didn't want to believe. That's it. They did not accept Jesus as the Son of David and everything that came with that. And they were indignant that somebody would even say that about Jesus. So it tells us what they thought about him, right? Else? I can almost see the disciples kind of taking Jesus aside after. Do you not know that these people were offended? Like, you really don't want to offend these people. Which again, we might think on the surface that that would be a common idea of the people, because these are supposed to be the religious leaders of the Jews. They should have been looking out for their best interests. But Jesus, in laying out who they really were, in that statement that he makes there, you know, whatever my God has not planted, he's going to uproot. He knows what he's saying, and he wants them to know that he knows what he's saying. And that in today's language, we might say Jesus is saying, yes, I know what I said, and I don't care, because it's the truth. Richard.
Peter and John answered and said unto them, whether it is right in the sight of God to hearken unto you rather than unto God, judge you. For we cannot but speak the things which we saw and heard.
Okay. Now, their rejection of Jesus didn't end when Jesus died. I am that person. Sorry about that. I have it off 99% of the time, wouldn't you know it? Yeah, the rejection of Jesus didn't stop with the death of Jesus, because when the apostles started teaching Jesus, you think they were just going to sit back and let them do that without any opposition? They thought he was dead, and so they thought their problems were over. But when he arose, you think they knew that he had risen from the dead too? There's no reason that we shouldn't believe that they knew like everybody else knew. And yet they still continued this rejection. And so when they started preaching about Jesus, everything that they were told in that account, and again in chapter 5 when they were arrested again, don't teach in this man's name anymore. And what happens when you don't have an answer for truth? You beat them up and tell them to be quiet. That was their only answer. Right. Right. Now, what are you doing that for? We don't want that. Very thing they ask for. Right. Hypocrisy is pretty much the word that describes them.
God's people are not supposed to be easily offended, because they're not saying it about us.
Right.
They're saying that to God. It goes straight to him.
Yeah. And the sooner we recognize that as disciples, that whatever insults we may receive, whatever persecution we may face, whatever comes our way because of our faith, we have to remember that, that it's not a personal thing. It's against Christ. It's against God that they're doing this. And if anything, that should embolden us, because it's not a personal attack, really. It's all about Christ. And I'm sure we all see in our society today, Christianity is the last religion out there that you can offend, and that's okay. All the other religions seem like you can't offend anybody in that religion or say anything derogatory about it, but you sure can Christianity. You know why that is? Because it's truth. I think, you think about it, everybody knows just by, if they know anything about all other religions, they know that it can't be true. But when you don't have an answer for truth, the only way you can overcome it is to silence it and silence the ones that are part of it by ridiculing it, marginalizing it, mislabeling it, demeaning it. I mean, everything you can do to bring it down, because you can't answer it. That's why all this is going on. Elvis, you know.
I think over the weekend, the New York Daily News ran the front page that,
right. That God's not going to fix this.
Prayer isn't fixing the problems of our country. And, you know, we need to take action through legislation to fix these hard moral issues that are going on with, you know, the shootings in California. So it's interesting that they attack Christianity when Christianity has to do with this. And,
yep.
One thing that could solve this problem, the one thing that would solve this problem, is the one thing that they're rejecting
right.
So wholeheartedly. It's utterly ironic.
Yeah, I like Matt Walt's response to that, that God can fix it if we would let him. If you follow Christianity, it would solve all the problems we have on earth right now.
I go back to the example of Stephen. You know, he made people so mad, they were trying to kill him with their teeth. They were
yeah.
You'd
be pretty upset. Yeah. And it was because of the statement, you murdered the Son of God. Richard, then Ken.
What we've the period of time that we call dark ages, there are groups that when people want to speak out against a prominent organization, then that organization will even put people to death.
Yep.
So they wouldn't make it back. But for Christians, we never make a big splash in the world. We just worship God, do our thing. But this group, they even call that period of time the golden age of the church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, you know, talking about what Elvis was talking about, it's interesting to me that the world will not read their scriptures and figure out that sons of Ishmael will be against the Israelites for all time. And they won't accept that.
It's politically incorrect. I mean, that's what it comes down to.
Yeah, they just won't believe history.
Yeah. Okay, any further comment on the accepting and rejecting? I think that the two groups were pretty distinct. And again, it doesn't mean that everybody in the religious leaders and everybody in the common people either rejected or accepted, but generally speaking, that's a pretty good description of who accepted and who rejected Jesus. And there were reasons for that. Same reasons that people reject or accept Jesus today is the same reasons they did then. It all goes to the heart. What are we really interested in? Are we really interested in what God wants us to do? If we are, then we're going to humble ourselves no matter what position we're in. Now, there was a religious leader that came to Jesus at night, John chapter 3. He was one of the religious leaders. What was Paul before he saw? He was a Pharisee. So we know that the gospel can reach honest hearts. But that's what it comes down to, the heart. And that's what we need to not forget today. It doesn't matter where in the world people are, what position they may be in. If we can bring them the gospel, it's their heart that's going to make the decision, the deciding factor, whether or not they accept or reject. And we can be the best speaker in the world, best teacher in the world, best personal worker, whatever term we want to use. But if they don't have a heart to hear it, it's not going to matter. But we still try. Richard?
Even some of the
All goes down to the heart. Derek?
And a good reference passage for this in 1 Corinthians 1 and 26. Paul here says, "For behold your calling, brethren, that not many wise after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called." He's acknowledging here that the majority, and there's obviously the gospel can appeal to everyone, but it's going to come from the unlearned, the people without influence. And if we can just look at the world today, I mean, where is the gospel growing? It's,
right.
It's not here. I mean, we are the wealth, we're the noble, we're,
yep.
we have all these great earthly blessings. The gospel's not growing here in America, unfortunately. It's growing in the poor countries in India and in the Philippines.
And the educated of this country say, well, of course they do, because they're ignorant and superstitious. No, it's because they're humble. And they know their place in the world, and they respect God's place. That's what it is.
And they're willing to conform to Christ
right.
with a noble heart and a pure heart. And that's what God is looking for, those that are willing to conform.
And when we get so rich, we start thinking that that's what makes our life what it is. And that's what life's all about. But those who don't have anything know they don't have anything. And they start looking at every aspect of their life and see that they don't have anything spiritual either. And they're at least humble enough to admit it. But when we get wealthy and educated, then we think we're smart and we know it all. And we have it all, so who needs God? Richard?
Along the same lines that Derek was bringing up, there in the Corinthian letter, Paul was telling us that the Jews
same chapter.
Two classes of people.
Yep.
That, you know, of course, there's three from Don to the other. Which one of the seven churches of Asia, but they said, we are rich and haven't even done it.
Right.
So we're going to have with Ephesus or Laodicea.
Laodiceans. Yep.
I mean, that's kind of conditioned when you start getting the idea that we don't need anything.
Yep. But he identify them as poor, wretched, and blind. That's what we've got to get to the point is where we see ourselves as God sees us. And then we recognize who we really are and what we really need. Okay, if we recognize the position and authority of Christ as King by looking at these passages, what should that mean to us personally? Because we can't look at all this and say, okay, he's King, and then not do anything with that. What does it mean to us personally? Should it mean? Yes.
I was thinking it has to do with recognizing our citizenship.
Okay.
And it manifests itself in two forms. One, like you said, the individual relationship with Christ, and then our collectiveness within the church.
Right.
And outside of that, really, nothing else should matter.
Right.
Yeah,
I think that would be true of, I'd say, any kingdom. You recognize, first of all, your relationship with the king, your place and his place, and then second, your relationship with your fellow citizens, which for us, we're talking about the church.
Obey him, submit yourself to him.
Okay. Which means what? If he's king, what does that mean, to obey and submit? Okay, how far?
Everyone.
I say that because there was a poll taken just as an example. I think this is just an example that really exemplifies society. There was a poll done by George Barna a few years ago, I think it was 2006, that asked, the first question was, do you believe the teachings of Jesus are binding? This was asked of people who profess to be believers. And rightly so, the numbers were high. I don't know why they weren't 100%, but they were like 92% said, yes, we believe the teachings of Jesus are binding. And then for whatever reason, they asked a series of questions then about some of the things that Jesus taught specifically. And one of the specifics was Matthew 19:9. You know how many people of those first 92% believed that that teaching was binding? 26%. And if I was the poll taker, I'd be going, didn't you just say that all the teachings of Jesus were binding? The reason I say, how far does his authority go? Because it's easy to say, yes, Jesus is my king, but when we get down to specifics is where we have the issues. All the things, right? And to me, it's amazing that there are entire denominations that teach certain commands of Jesus are not necessary. Like, he that believes and is baptized shall be saved. I heard a lesson one time. I drove by a church when I was living in St. Charles, Missouri, that had on their sign, is baptism necessary for salvation next Sunday night? So I wrote him, or I called the number, and said, could I have the tape from that lesson because I want to hear it. I had to hear what they had to say. And he spent 25 minutes talking about why Acts 2:38 didn't really mean what it said. Acts 22:16 didn't mean that baptism actually washed away sins. And 1 Peter 3:21 didn't really mean what it said. And then at the end of his lesson said, but you need to be baptized because Jesus commanded it. Well, if it's not necessary, why do you need to obey it? But that's what man does. He'll look and say, yes, Jesus is my king. But when it gets to a particular, then maybe not.
People do that. They raise up other men, even besides Christ, to these levels. But then when something they say they don't like, they just almost forget that it exists.
Right.
A good example of that is Martin Luther King. There are so many other things that he said not related to race
right.
that were absolutely true.
Yep.
But we almost act as if he didn't say those things.
Right. Why?
Because that's not the person that they want.
Yep. Not comfortable. And probably could say that about anybody, any man that we take a quote from. That's why I'm careful about the quotes that I quote. Because some people, I'm just not going to quote them. I don't care what they say. I don't want to be associated with that person. I'm sure you could find a good quote from Adolf Hitler if you wanted to. I'm not going to do it, even if he's telling the truth. Let's stick with people of good character. Let's stick with what this says and not worry about what men say. But when we get too concerned about what society or everybody else thinks, then that's when we start backing off of Jesus really being our king. If we get wrapped up in our society, our political system, our political network, how it's established, and particularly this country, we get so wrapped up in being American, we forget that Jesus is the king. Mr. Obama may be president, but Jesus is always the king. But we can get those mixed up and forget where our citizenship really is, and then forget that he is supposed to be ruling over everything. That's all of our time for today. Let's pick up with the text of Matthew 3 on page 8 and get into the second major theme on the